I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This holiday season, discover the true meaning of Christmas in all of us.
I'm not really into the holidays. Sorry.
Jack Wormby thought he had it all. A big city job, a beautiful wife, and a phone that worked in his car. But his life was missing one thing.
I am Santa Talos, here to administer full Christmas. I bring hot change forged in life.
It's burning my skin!
It's the story of one man, one Bronze Age automaton, and a whole lot of Christmas cheer.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part 3 of our exploration of invented toys. In the previous episodes, we talked about stuff like the Frisbee, the Jack in the Box, the Slinky, the Hula Hoop. What else do we do?
Oh, we did jigsaw puzzles. We did, Jack in the Box.
We can't remember what we talk about on here.
Yeah, hula hoop, frisbee, a number of different toys. I mean, really, you just got to go back in the bag and start digging around to see what we discussed.
But today I wanted to start off by talking about one of the most basic toys you could possibly have. You know, when I was a kid, I had lots of favorite toys. I remember being very partial to some branded Jurassic Park action figures. And I had the car, like the car that the T-Rex steps on.
So there's like a Sam Neill action figure?
Totally. Okay. Sam Neill action figure. He's got the hat on. And one of the funny things about the Jurassic Park action figures is that they would come with weapons that they did not possess at all in the film. So they've got like an Ellie Sattler action figure, Laura Dern's likeness, mm-hmm. with like a grappling hook gun. Like,
oh, man.
I don't remember the scene in the movie where she had that.
Well, this was the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And I was... You're a little younger than me, so I wasn't at action figure age at this point anymore.
Mm-hmm. I was beyond it, but still going.
Well, I don't know. That's a whole another discussion, because ultimately my take is you can get action figures anytime you want during your life, because all they are ultimately they're deities. They're little icons that inspire you, and you can play with them or just be inspired by them at any point in your life. But mm-hmm. At that point in my life, they weren't really on my radar. But now I'm excited by the idea of having a Jeff Goldblum action figure.
Yeah, what weapon did Jeff Goldblum have? I think maybe he had a gun that shot a net or something. Why would he have that? Maybe it was shooting like a graph for like mapping the grids of his parabolas and all that when he's doing his calculations.
There is that theme in action figures especially where it's like it's not enough that you have the likeness of a person or a creature or an entity it's not enough that you can then engage in imagination play with it and even pose it. I like having a poseable figure. I grew up in the era of G.I. Joes and it was nice to have all those joints move.
Right.
But then there's this level of like, nope, it needs some sort of gun. It needs
something. It's got to have a gun.
It's got to have some sort of, not only a something that looks like a gun, a functional projectile implement that can fire the grappling hook or the net at another action figure. And I think it's largely about so you can have that action moment in the commercial where one figure does something to knock over another.
Yes, that's totally it. I think it may also be driven on the supply side sometimes, like, oh, we figured out how to make this little shooter thing. What action figure can we pair that with?
Yes, yeah. And we'll come back to this discussion of action figures and movie and TV properties towards the end of the episode.
Right, but I want to go way simpler than that. So this has no guns, no moving parts, no likenesses of Sam Neill or Laura Dern. I had lots of favorite toys, but what did I get the most sustained enjoyment out of? I think it's got to be blocks, right?
Yeah.
Like, I spent more time with building blocks than any other kind of toy because, of course, blocks can be anything. So there's like an infinite amount of play that you can do with them, though I still remember the pain of trying to build with blocks in a room completely covered in soft carpet. That way lies death.
Yeah.
You know, like you build a tower, but then you smite its ruin on the carpeted stair because it's just unstable.
It's true. Yeah, I also have a lot of fond memories of playing with this one set of standard wooden blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of them were standard, but you also had some specialty pieces. I was especially pleased with these double arches that you could use.
Oh, yeah.
That could be used to make a bridge, or you could put them together to make like a circular entrance in something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of my imagination play with them was based on Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes.
Those scenes where Indiana Jones and others are going into these, you know, ridiculously unrealistic tomb spaces, these big, you know, antechambers and so forth. And, you know, I just had to reconstruct those and send some G.I. Joes down there.
I think blocks are very interesting as toys because building with blocks is a kind of play that combines the ultimate in freedom and the ultimate in constraint, right? It has like no established goals, rules, no winning conditions, and thus it's not really a game. And yet it has extremely tight and non-negotiable constraints based in physics and materials. And so it's a very different kind of play than a lot of the imagination play that you would do where, mm-hmm. you know, you might have action figures there where, you know, your action figure play is just not very limited by physics usually. A lot of it's just like happening in the imagination with the action figure as a prop.
Mm-hmm.
A different thing is going on with the blocks. Like you're trying to stack them on top of each other. You're trying to get them to behave, to like stand up in a certain way. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have like this basic physical enterprise at the heart of your play, no matter how much imagination you then put on top of that.
Yeah, so asking the question when toy blocks were invented, obviously we don't know that. It seems that people have been using various kinds of homemade toy building materials for centuries, maybe even thousands of years, but we just frankly don't know when it began. So I was reading a great article on the history of blocks as tools for learning and as toys by an author named Karen Hewitt, who is a scholar of education. She's a toy designer, and she has curated museum exhibitions on the history of educational toys. This article was called Blocks as a Tool for Learning, a Historical and Contemporary Perspective, published in the journal Young Children in 2001. And so Hewitt begins by observing that building-based play among children probably predates dedicated block toys because you can even watch children today improvise with building-based play using natural materials like rocks and sticks or constructed or artificial materials often discarded by adults, you know, like construction scrap, containers, boxes. I remember getting so much enjoyment out of empty boxes when I was young.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Empty boxes are loads of fun. And on top of that, of course, you know, the children of builders will inevitably not only play with the debris left over from building, but they will imitate the building activity that they see in the parents.
Sure. Just watching the way kids pick up things that are not specifically intended as toy building materials and then turn them into toy building materials, that makes it pretty clear that construction play probably long predates having dedicated toy blocks. Even you can think about sandcastles. I wonder how long have people been making sandcastles? Were, you know, Neolithic peoples making sandcastles? It's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the sandcastles, just playing in the sand, digging in the sand, there's just something irresistible about it.
Yeah. So I think it's clear that building blocks are not a toy that invents a fundamentally new kind of play the way, say, a Slinky or a Jack in the Box would. There's no way to play with a Slinky before the Slinky existed. There's no way to play with the Jack in the Box before that existed. But you could basically have blocks in nature, you know, rocks, sticks, all that kind of stuff. Rather, I think toy blocks offer a clean, safe, and convenient way of facilitating the kind of construction play that children pick up naturally without any prompting whenever random materials are available. Though I do have a question about this, and I couldn't find an answer to this. Does Homo sapiens have a building instinct that would manifest even without any exposure to a culture of construction and artificial structures? Or do children need to see artificial structures and witness adults building things in order to get the urge to build as play?
Yeah, that's a tough one to – I mean, almost an impossible one to investigate.
Yeah.
It's like studying unlanguaged children. It would require an act of extreme deprivation in order to study what it would be like.
Uh-huh.
It's like to deny a child access to like blocks or the idea of blocks,
uh-huh,
to the idea of play. That's just something that's very difficult, if not impossible, to study.
I'm not suggesting we try it.
No, absolutely not.
So Hewitt points out that thinkers have long connected children's orientation toward construction-based play with learning and the needs of a developing brain. She mentions Plato, Comenius, Pestalozzi, and Jean Piaget. And apparently this even came up with the English Enlightenment philosopher John Locke in 1693 in a treatise called Some Thoughts Concerning Education. John Locke wrote, quote, "The chief art is to make all that children have to do, sport and play too. Learning anything they should be taught might be made as much a recreation to their play as their play is to their learning."
Ah.
So specifically, Locke here points to children's play with what we now know today as alphabet blocks. They existed at the time too. I don't think they were being like mass manufactured at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't like, big toy companies putting these out. But some kids just had blocks they were playing with that had letters inscribed on them.
This reminds me of the origins of the jigsaw puzzle, or more specifically the dissected map that we discussed in the last episode, something that began as not even a mass-produced toy but like an educational aid.
Yes, and this would have been not always as fully accepted and intuitive as it is to us today. Like, so Locke's actually trying to make a case for using a child's natural tendency towards play as a means of education. Like, he's saying if the child automatically wants to play with alphabet blocks, it is no chore, and thus the child better learns the alphabet. And to put this in context, a lot of the prevailing sentiment about childhood education in late 17th century England would have focused on like hard work and discipline through threats of punishment. And Locke instead emphasized that children could learn through play and enjoyment. And Hewitt suggests that this view contributed to a sort of reevaluation of toys, with more adults coming to see them, to see toys less as like sinful icons of idleness and more as tools for informing and exercising a developing mind, something that's actually a social good and useful. I'm not sure if the same would apply to Laura Dern's grappling hook gun, but I think you could definitely make the case with building blocks.
Yes.
So Hewitt writes that in the mid to late 19th century, some manufacturers in Europe and the U.S. actually then began to mass produce building block toys. And this could often be kind of a side business of something. Like, imagine you've got a woodworking company and you're cutting wood for, you know, whatever it is that you're mainly selling. You tend to have a lot of small scraps of wood left over. Could you actually turn those for a profit? Could you shape them into building blocks and make money off of what would otherwise be a waste product? And Hewitt writes that since the mid-19th century, there have been three main avenues linking learning and play with respect to toy blocks. So the first one's what we're already talking about. It's building itself. It's learning about basic physics and material properties with hands-on building experience. This is, of course, one of the most important parts of education. Sometimes it gets underemphasized when we think about education because it's not a technical subject you really learn in school. It's something that children just have to learn intuitively with hands-on experience in the world.
Absolutely. It just allows for further experimentation with the natural properties of reality.
Sure. And then, okay, so the second thing is surfaces of blocks as a place to represent symbols like letters, numbers, words. Of course, we already talked about the example of alphabet blocks, and thus using the blocks as a way of learning how to manipulate those symbols. Like Hewitt says that this pairing of abstract symbols with blocks really exploded in the mid-1800s. And it seems like a very relevant type of learning today, like allowing the child to physically move symbols around in real space. This sort of is a physical model of the way we metaphorically move symbols around in mental space to manipulate them.
Yeah, basically engaging our, you know, the visual processes of our brain as well.
Yeah.
These are still tremendously helpful. You see them sometimes to aid in acquisition of foreign languages, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, did you ever, when you were a kid, use like those sort of balancing scale games with physical objects to learn algebra? Like, so if you're trying to balance two sides of an equation in math?
No. I feel like my math education was very based in just, you know, rote memorization of things.
Oh, no.
You know, memorizing tables, learning tricks. And so I'm really with a second grader who's going through like modern math education, mm-hmm. it's been very interesting to see just this seemingly drastic different approach to learning how numbers work and how quantities compare to each other. It's at times it's difficult for me to even help him with it because I feel like our math educations are so different.
Uh-huh.
But the way they're teaching him, I think, is far superior to what I had.
Oh, you're not going to be one of those adults complaining that kids aren't learning stuff the same way you learned it?
No. I'm thank goodness they're learning it a different way, because the way I learned it, I feel like, did not give me a true appreciation for mathematics.
Yeah. I feel much the same way, but I think that's such a funny impulse people have, isn't it? Like, it's like they're not learning it the way I did. The way I did has got to be superior somehow.
They're not learning it poorly like I did. I will not stand for it. No, I want my kid to be able to actually think about numbers in ways that have eluded me my whole life.
Yeah. And then there's one third main way that Hewitt mentions that blocks have been linked with learning, and that's the transmission of cultural heritage through blocks. Mm-hmm. An example here would be, quote, building a model of an important architectural structure and through this process learning architectural styles. In fact, an example I was just thinking of was the original Lincoln Logs. You know, these were created by Frank Lloyd Wright's son.
Really?
I can't remember his first name, but one of the sons of Frank Lloyd Wright. He got a Lincoln log business going, and one of the original things that you were supposed to do with Lincoln logs, like you got these instructions on how to build Abraham Lincoln's log cabin.
Huh. Yeah, Lincoln logs. Okay, I'll acknowledge that Lincoln logs do succeed as an educational toy in educating you in the basic way that a log cabin is constructed.
Uh-huh.
But that's pretty much it. I always found them to be a very boring toy. Like you play with them once and you're like, oh, yeah, that's okay. That's all I can do with this. I'm going to go build something out of a block that allows me to engage my mind a bit more.
I was reading an old New York Times article in about blocks by the Canadian-American architect and UPenn professor Witold Rybczynski. And his comment about Lincoln logs was, it was something like, well, at least they smelled good.
Yeah, I mean, they were wooden. I mean, I don't hate Lincoln logs, but they never really resonated with me.
Uh-huh.
But they certainly survived due to that. In I think the first episode we did on toys, we talked about this idea that toys have a 20-year cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That you have a certain toy as a child, and then 20 years later, you know, give or take, if you have children or there are children in your life at all, you're likely to give that toy anew if it's still on the market, still available.
Uh-huh.
And Lincoln Logs are exactly like that. My son received Lincoln Logs from members of the family just because of that nostalgia.
And how do they smell?
They smell fine, and you can still build a little cabin out of it and then set them aside to go do something more fun.
But of course, another thing Hewitt points out is that there are plenty of cases of blurring of the lines between these categories, right? Because, for example, a thing that was, I think, very common in the 19th century was like you'd have a set of blocks that you sold as a set that would represent elements of Bible stories.
Hmm.
And this combines using the blocks themselves as a representation space for symbols or referring to things somewhere else, but then also transmitting cultural heritage through the Bible story aspect.
I don't think I've ever seen this. Would it have been essentially – it wasn't sequential art, right? It wasn't
– I think there was some sequential art like that, like Bible story sequential art. Then I think it was also like, you know, build Noah's Ark or something.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds like a good fit. Noah's Ark is the most child-friendly portion of pretty much the whole Bible, so –
Oh, did they have blocks of all the other people on the earth getting drowned to death?
No, we just focus on the animals. That's,
right.
That's the main thing.
So she goes into the history of a lot of individual block manufacturers and their businesses. I decided I'm not going to go into all that here, just to touch on a couple more broad issues. Though it is actually interesting, and this paper is worth looking up and giving a read if you want to go deeper on just like what some of these manufacturers were doing individually. But Hewitt points out that despite the attempts to use blocks for education in numbers and letters and so forth, children most often play with blocks in terms of pure form. Like that when you actually watch the way children engage with blocks, most of the time, they ignore the symbolic representations. Mm-hmm. They ignore the letters on the alphabet blocks, and instead they use them to build. They build little towers and little cities. Usually the form and the physical base of construction play seems more relevant to the child's mind than the abstract content does. I don't know how that squares with your experience, but
yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. It does with mine.
Yeah.
Like if I had the Bible blocks, I think I would just be trying to build like an Indiana Jones temple out of them.
Yeah. I think that was my experience with alphabet blocks as a kid. Uh-huh. I would use them to a certain extent to build with, but they didn't provide as much flexibility in terms of what you ultimately built compared to an actual block set that had varying sizes. There's only so much you can do with identical cubes.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, I remember we were gifted a very nice set of wooden alphabet blocks and character blocks when my son came into our life because they would have Mandarin characters on them,
cool.
Which was very cool. And you know, you get kind of excited about yes, the learning tool that is this block set. But then you know, ultimately the kid's not that interested in them and just wants to do you know, age appropriate things with them, which uh-huh. I guess he was like one and a half at that point. And, you know, he just wants to knock them over or throw them. He doesn't want to actually build and much less think about the characters all that much.
Oh, but that's actually interesting because another thing Hewitt talks about, she makes a point about the importance of the tearing down aspect of block play.
Oh, yes.
She says this is a crucial element that's underemphasized in some of the, you know, pedagogical theory or maybe underappreciated by even some parents. There's a section where she says, quote, "The destructive or deconstructive activity characteristic of block play, an integral part of this activity, makes some adults uncomfortable.
Yes.
However, as in all learning, we cannot understand until we take apart, examine, and rebuild." So, you know, she's making a point that a lot of parents might look at their child's tendency to want to like knock over a tower of blocks and smash it and everything. And you say, oh, no, is my child some kind of, you know, little King Kong, a little Godzilla?
Yeah.
Are they just pure destructive impulse? But she's suggesting, no, this is also an important part of learning. It's not something to be afraid of.
No, yeah, not at all. But I mean, it can be frustrating. I've been frustrated with it when my son was much younger,
mm-hmm.
you know, because because you want to engage with them, you want to play with them, you want to play blocks with your child. Mm-hmm. But in doing that, you're like, let's build something together. And then the kid maybe is not that much into building or is not very good at it, but then wants to destroy it at every level of construction. or sometimes you encounter it too, where you have differing age groups and children. And so you have like the kid who's old enough to really want to build stuff, mm-hmm. be it with blocks or a sandcastle or what have you. But the younger kid just wants to Godzilla the heck out of that sand city.
Uh-huh.
And you just have to realize that's kind of how they learn. They're at a dissection stage of architecture.
Sure, like both phases are important.
Yeah, they're all about destroying new buildings. Einstürzende Neubauten.
You know, one last thing that was in this paper that I just point out because it's funny is that there's a part where she talks – this was published in 2001, and she talks about the sort of recent development of digital construction environments, which are like computer games that are marketed as an alternative to physical blocks. And mm-hmm. the way she writes about it, it seems like she's a little bit skeptical of that these would – you know, replace physical blocks. Because, you know, if it's 2001, you're thinking, what, kids want to play with their hands? Why would you right. have digital 3D blocks? But then I was thinking, like, wait a minute, Minecraft?
yeah, there are plenty of examples of it. But I, too, am skeptical because, yeah, there is something about the physical act of, mm-hmm. of building. And even if you have great physics in a virtual setting, which many of these games do,
sure,
there's nothing like having the actual block there.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You got to have the physical objects there, especially for younger kids, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's once you get older that you can, like, abstract that level of play out to a – you know, an imagined space.
Or to come back to the Jack-in-the-Box,
uh-huh.
Let's not discount the alarming noise of an epic wooden block tower falling onto the kitchen floor.
I love that.
I think that also is an important part of the experience.
Another disadvantage of playing on carpeted floor, right?
Yeah.
So it's harder to build because the floor is less stable, but also when it finally falls over, you don't even get the clatter.
Yeah, you don't scare everybody in the house and the dog and the cat to boot.
Horrible. This is my PSA for this episode. Find a place with solid, hard floors for your children to play with blocks on. Don't make them play on carpet.
Yes.
All right, it's time to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more invention about toys.
Hey, everybody. Audible has the world's largest selection of audiobooks and audio entertainment, including Audible Originals.
Audible Originals are stories created exclusively for audio, including documentaries, exclusive audiobooks, and scripted shows that you can't hear anywhere else.
Audible keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. You'll finish more stories when you listen with Audible and always be a part of the conversation.
With the convenient Audible app, which I use, you can listen anytime, anywhere, and on any device, mobile, Alexa-enabled, Bluetooth, and more.
Listen at the gym, while shopping, in the car, while traveling. Anytime you can't read, you can listen with Audible.
Audible members get more than ever before. Every month, you can choose one audiobook regardless of price, as well as two Audible originals from a fresh selection. Members stay motivated and inspired with unlimited access to exclusive guided fitness and meditation programs. You can sign up for free updates from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post delivered daily to the app.
And get this, Audible members can easily exchange any title they don't love at any time.
Members keep their library of listens forever, even if they cancel.
So start a 30-day trial and choose one audiobook plus two Audible originals absolutely free.
This is a great thing. I use the Audible app all the time in my personal life. I was just traveling the other day. I was on an airplane, and I was listening to the old classic audiobook of Lord of the Rings. I was in the Two Towers listening to the Rob Inglis reading. I don't know if there are others, but that one's great. You know, he like sings all the songs. It's wonderful.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's a great one to check out if you want to roam Middle Earth. I love the way he sings the Tom Bombadil song. It's so good.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we're super into the Neverending Story right now,
uh-huh.
Which you will also find on Audible. And this is important, too, because it will come up in the next section that we're going to discuss on the show.
Oh, really? Well, I'm excited for that. You, the listener, start listening. Get Audible. Start with a 30-day Audible trial. Choose one audiobook and two Audible originals absolutely free. Visit audible.com/invention or text invention to 500-500. Again, that's audible.com/invention or text invention to 500-500.
All right, we're back. So we just talked about traditional blocks, wooden blocks, a little bit of log cabin action in there, some alphabet blocks as well.
But I think we all know that there is sort of a final form of blocks in principle. You know, like how the Power Rangers continually morph up into bigger and better robots. Mm-hmm. The ultimate robot that they could achieve, I think, would have to be the Lego.
Absolutely. Legos. These were a huge part of my childhood growing up in the 80s and 90s. These interlocking plastic bricks and the various building accessories that come with them allow you to construct everything from castles to helicopters to spaceships. And I would generally build what the instructions told me to. You know, I'd follow the instructions once. Mm-hmm. Then I'd throw the directions away, and then I would just free build whatever I wanted, usually more castles, helicopters, and spaceships, but, you know, of my own design.
Uh-huh.
For instance, I remember watching the 1983 helicopter film Blue Thunder at what was almost certainly, far too young an age for an R-rated action film.
Uh-huh.
And I became obsessed with the two choppers in the film. It was a police attack chopper piloted by Roy Scheider.
Oh, from Jaws.
Yeah. And then the Hughes 500 chopper piloted by evil test pilot Malcolm McDowell of course, Caligula and A Clockwork Orange fame.
How have I never seen this?
And then, I should also point out, Daniel Stern also had a role playing a voyeuristic creep, of course.
Of course. He was really getting typecast as creeps in the late 80s period.
Yeah.
Or I guess this would have been earlier. So how did he bust out of creep phase and become the narrator of the Wonder Years?
Well, maybe like a sight unseen casting, because he has a great creep look. Uh-huh. And plays a fantastic creep. I mean, why try and get away from what works? And Daniel Stern is a natural. It's that six-pack life that he's living.
Okay. But so this movie got you building Lego helicopters.
Yeah. And going back to our destructive aspect of play, mm-hmm. One of my favorite things to do was to build the two Blue Thunder helicopters and have them duel, and then, then have one of them crash. And that's the great thing about a Lego constructed vehicle is when it crashes, it breaks into pieces. Mm-hmm. You have this believable, destruction, and then you can perhaps have the little pilot have to put that chopper back together so that he can get back in the sky mm-hmm. and defeat Malcolm McDowell once and for all.
Wow. Again, destruction, an important part of play.
Yeah. Like going back to blocks real quick, I remember one thing that I would do a lot with my wooden blocks was build a wall. And then I had a battery-powered G.I. Joe tank mm-hmm. that would just move forward on these cool tracks uh-huh. and just have that drive into the wall and see if I could build a wall strong enough to keep the tank from plowing through it, and then also figure out how to make the tank approach the wall so as to bust through.
I think I did something almost exactly like this with a remote control car. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to build something that it couldn't get through. Yeah.
Yeah. So, say what you will about war toys, and we'll have something to say about that in a minute. Like a nice remote control or just powered tank toy or mm-hmm. vehicle toy, it's great to send it at a wall of blocks. So Legos, fast forward 20 years via the 20-year rule we've been talking about, and I have introduced my own son to the joy of Legos, and he's into them big time. He's more obsessed with instructions than I was, but he does some free construction as well. He likes to make creatures out of them, and most recently he made a Falcor from The NeverEnding Story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He also loves the Harry Potter kits, especially the ones that have creatures in them. Mm-hmm. Also, some of the Lego dinosaur kits he really digs. And I should also drive home that stepping on Legos is still absolutely no fun, but an important part of the experience.
So we've got to have the backstory of the Lego, right? Where does this wonderful, delightful toy come from?
Well, it ties in nicely with the history of building blocks themselves, because, of course, you cannot have Lego building blocks without all the forms that came before, especially just basic wooden blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it does begin in a carpenter shop with pretty much the same scenario we were talking about earlier, where a carpenter might construct toys out of leftover materials, etc. And this particular master carpenter and joiner was a man by the name of Ole Kirk Christensen, who worked in the village of Billund, Denmark. So he opened his shop in 1932, selling mostly household wooden goods like ladders and things, but he also sold some toys on the side. But the toys became increasingly important to his business. Mm-hmm. In 1934, the company ends up adopting the name Lego from the Danish leg got, which means play well. And by accident, it also Lego also means I put together in Latin, apparently. Nice. And then in 1935, they marketed a wooden duck toy. They had a construction game, that sort of thing. And they just kept continually building on this. In 1946, the company bought a plastic injection molding machine. And by 1949, the company was putting out 200 different plastic and wooden toys, mostly, I understand, you know, for sale in Denmark. And one of the toys that they put out were automatic binding bricks.
Hmm.
These were interlocking bricks made out of plastic. And if you look at pictures of them, there are pictures of them available on the in the history section of Lego's website. You'll see that they mostly resemble Lego the Lego blocks of today with some, you know, some noticeable differences. But the basic design is there, the little cylindrical bits on the top that allow them to interlock.
You know, it's funny. I would think with Legos that they must actually have some pretty tight design parameters to fit as well as they do. You know, they don't have like parts that like lock in place with any moving mechanisms, mm-hmm. right? So they just have to lock in place by pure rigid shape alone. And this involves like them being just like the pegs on the top fitting into the things on the bottom just well enough that they stay together, but, you know, not so tightly that it's tough to put them together or tough to pull them apart.
Right. Yeah. They have to work, and they apparently work pretty hard experimenting with them over the years to really get the fit, you know, tight and dependable.
Mm-hmm.
They were experimenting with the plastic and the plastic construction. They were not the first interlocking block or brick, however. The key predecessor to all this would have been, I was reading, the Kittycraft self-locking building brick, which was invented by Hilary Fisher Page, who lived 1904 through 1957. But the automatic binding bricks of Lego were the immediate predecessor to the Lego blocks we know today. They were only sold in Denmark at first, and then in 1953, they got a new name, Lego Mersten, or Lego Bricks. And they steadily expanded from there, hitting the U.S. and Canada in 61. They go from a regional toy to an international success. Now, one thing I was thinking about regarding Lego and my own history of playing with Lego Blue Thunder toys, choppers blowing each other out of the sky, obviously, there was never an actual Blue Thunder movie tie-in Lego kit. I know it's hard to imagine a time when there were not a million Lego movie tie-ins on the shelf, but I started thinking about it, and I was like, oh, you know, I don't know that I ever saw, say, an Apache helicopter Lego or any kind of a military helicopter Lego or a tank or you know, anything of that matter. I mean, you'll see some science fiction, you know, battle type stuff, some fantasy stuff, and to a certain extent, medieval weaponry with the castles. But you don't really see any war toys, despite the fact that there would clearly be a market for that.
Sure.
If say Lego were to put out Lego models of, say, you know, stealth fighter, stealth bomber, mm-hmm. you know the Osprey, whatever the military aircraft happens to be, they're neat planes. They would make neat kits, right? Seems like a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking into this and a little bit more, and I ran across an excerpt from a 2010 progress report that really drives home some of the key decision making that goes on here. And I do think this does get into the idea of destructive play, constructive play, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Lego posts these kind of reports every year addressing a variety of topics that you might expect a major toy manufacturer to tackle, including social and environmental issues on top of, you know, more business level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular progress report spelled out their key philosophy on weapons and war in their toys. And so I just want to read this. Again, this is coming directly from Lego, so just bear in mind you're hearing like corporate messaging here.
Right.
But I think it does reveal a lot. Quote, a large number of Lego minifigures use weapons and are, assumedly, regularly being charged by each other's weapons as part of children's role play. In the Lego group, we acknowledge that conflict in play is especially prevalent among 4 to 9 year old boys. An inner drive and a need to experiment with their own aggressive feelings in order to learn about other people's aggressions exists in most children. This in turn enables them to handle and recognize conflict in non-play scenarios. As such, the LEGO Group sees conflict play as perfectly acceptable and an integral part of children's development. We also acknowledge children's well-proven ability to tell play from reality. However, to make sure to maintain the right balance between play and conflict, we have adhered to a set of unwritten rules for several years. In 2010, we have formalized these rules in a guideline for the use of conflict and weapons in LEGO products. The basic aim is to avoid realistic weapons and military equipment that children may recognize from hotspots around the world and to refrain from showing violent or frightening situations when communicating about LEGO products. At the same time, the purpose is for the LEGO brand not to be associated with issues that glorify conflicts and unethical or harmful behavior.
So the idea is that they are comfortable with allowing conflict play, including, you know, weapons and stuff in, say, historical settings or fantasy settings or sci-fi settings, but not having, like, guns that you would recognize on, you know, being used in violence and armed conflict today.
Correct, yeah. And I looked around at some of the more recent reports to see if they'd they had a more recent voicing of this philosophy, and I was not able to come across it. It might exist out there. LEGO has a, you know, puts out a lot of communication, but it seems to be this seems to be the standard they're still operating by. And I think that's I acknowledge that this makes sense for a especially for a an international company, you know, that isn't say just situated in the United States, for instance. Say for instance, LEGO put out a Predator drone kit,
right?
Like that would be awful because the context would be different, obviously in different parts of the world, and arguably like this particular kit, if it were to exist, would bring a lot of ethical baggage with it. That you wouldn't necessarily want to inflict upon a child who just wants to engage in the kind of play we're discussing here.
Yeah. This has got me thinking. I think conflict play and violence in play could be something we come back to and do an episode on and stuff to blow your mind. Because it's something that, again, it's kind of like with destructive play with blocks, you know, like knocking down towers and stuff. It's the kind of thing that I can totally understand why parents would look at it. And say, like, this can't be healthy. Something's wrong here. And yet, you know, obviously millions of people around the world grow up playing at games in which the children pretend to kill each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, use toy guns and all that kind of stuff. And it doesn't necessarily translate to, you know, real aggressive or violent behavior in adults. Maybe in some cases it does, but it doesn't appear to necessarily lead to that conclusion. So I wonder what the actual research says about that.
Yeah, it would be fun to do a deeper dive in it. Because on another level, what children are doing in imagination play is they're making up stories, telling stories, and retelling stories.
Yeah.
For instance, if you're playing with there is a particular LEGO kit that is it's a small one, and it's just about one of the showdowns between Harry Potter and Voldemort, which is a battle, which is a fight between a murderous villain and the hero of the tale, which of course is central to – it's the kind of conflict you have in so many myths, so many legends, so many important stories. And so, you know, conflict play to a certain extent is about embracing this aspect of our narratives.
Yeah, it seems to me impossible that you could, like, remove a child's desire to explore themes of conflict in their play and in their imagination. I guess the question is just, like, what types of physical toys and models actually, I don't know, would drive development in unhealthy directions? I don't know if we actually have any answers about that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, a whole other issue, of course, is toy guns, you know?
Yeah. And I had toy guns when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. I had some very realistic looking, like you would just have a water gun that just looks like a straight up Uzi, black and everything, you know, and not brightly colored so that it's obvious. And nowadays, like we've you know, for a few different reasons, we've not let our son play with toy guns. But then on the other hand, he's into Harry Potter. He has the wands. And so he'll go over to play with a friend and they're just shooting straight death curses at each other.
Yeah, it's just a gun. You know? Yeah.
It's like they're treating it kind of like a gun, and they are flinging forbidden curses. What are they called?
I don't know.
Anyway, the bad curses you're not supposed to use, the death curses, the Crucio curses.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the pain one, right?
Yeah. Like we were, in fact, he was dressed as Harry Potter when we were trick-or-treating. We went past a house and he was like, we should go to that one. And I'm like, I don't think that one's open. They don't have their lights on. They don't have any candy. And he just points his wand at the house and says, Incendio. Very coldly. I was like, man, that's cold.
Oh.
All right, but
brutal.
back to Legos. Another interesting angle that I came across regarding Legos has to do with what these blocks are constructed out of.
Sure.
And, of course, they are made out of plastic. I was reading a 2018 New York Times article by Stanley Reed titled, Lego Wants to Completely Remake Its Toy Bricks Without Anyone Noticing. Now, that title gives pretty much everything away. There's no mystery what that article's about.
Uh-huh.
But the main point is that Lego wants to eliminate its dependence on petroleum-based plastics and build its toys entirely from plant-based or recycled materials by 2030. And this is quite a challenge because the Lego block, which hopefully everyone listening has some familiarity with it, like these are durable blocks.
Yeah.
They stand the test of time. I'm able to use blocks from my childhood and build things with my son using new blocks, and you can't really tell the difference. Mm-hmm. unless a block has been chewed on by a dog or something. They hold up really well. They hold their color. They're able to dependably interlock with each other. They can be stepped on. They can go through the wash. You name it. But at the end of the day, they are plastic products that are made from petroleum. And so Lego has been eyeing plant fibers, recycled bottles, and they want to get away from that petroleum-based origin. Namely, they want to get away from ABS plastic, which they've depended on. This is the kind of plastic you find in computer keys and in many mobile phone cases.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. It's slightly elastic. And it has a polished surface, so it looks nice.
Mm-hmm.
Reed points out in this article that at the time of its publication, 2018, Lego had already experimented with something like 200 different alternatives to ABS plastic. And at that point, nothing had really worked. So a particular solution might be too brittle. It might break. And if it broke, in some cases, it might break into sharpened pieces, which is no good for a children's toy.
Right.
In other cases, it might be aesthetic. The colors wouldn't look right, et cetera. So the quest continues at Lego, apparently, to find a proper ABS plastic substitute, something that is more sustainable, that is less dependent on petroleum. But it is another interesting thing to think about when it comes to toys, the toys that we make, the toys that we have as part of our childhood and then recreate again and share with children in our lives, is that they are made out of materials.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a lot about older toys that are made out of wood and so forth, but so many of our toys in the modern age are made out of plastic.
Well, yeah, I mean, whatever kind of like large scale or maybe environmental downsides you might point to, I mean, it's clear why plastic is so dominant in the market. I mean, it has undeniable material benefits for especially the kinds of uses you want in a children's toy.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to form and to different shapes and mass produce like that. It's relatively safe.
Yeah, it really has made Lego possible.
Yeah.
Like you go back to that woodworker's origin, it was not really possible to make an interlocking brick that works as well as a plastic brick with wooden materials.
Oh, man. Yeah, trying to imagine wooden Legos. I wonder if somebody's out there doing that. That's like somebody's passion craft.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could be completely wrong here, but I'm guessing you could make some form of metal Lego, but that also doesn't sound like a great idea.
Man, you think stepping on the plastic ones are bad.
Wait till you step on the steel Lego. All right, we're going to move on to another toy here. This next one is not going to be as much of an in-depth discussion, but I decided to look into the origin of a toy that I don't know if anybody feels particularly strongly about in a positive manner, but I'm talking about the cymbal-banging monkey. That mechanical.
Is that a toy?
I guess it's a toy. It is a toy.
Sure.
It is. If the Jack in the Box is a toy, then the cymbal banging monkey is.
I think of it as a prop in a horror film.
Yeah, it's mainly what it does these days.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sure everyone's familiar with it. It is a chimpanzee, generally in a sitting or squatting position. It is wearing some sort of baby clothing, generally.
Creepy.
It has a pair of cymbals, which it crashes together over and over again mechanically.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes there's, you know, there's movement to the eyes and to the like the teeth, and its eyes generally have this kind of like red rimmed appearance to them that makes it look like it is completely insane.
It has the devil inside it. Yes.
Yes. So I was looking into this, like, where did this come from? And basically, it seems to go back to the idea of organ grinders.
Oh, okay.
You would have some, you know, somebody, a street musician, essentially, with a performing monkey that may be dressed in small clothing, you know, doll clothing or children's clothing, maybe brandishing some sort of an instrument. Mm-hmm. It's all about amusing people and getting them to give you some money, you know, for the amusement.
Mm-hmm.
And then this would be the mechanical version of it. And I've seen it traced back to the musical Jolly Chimp created by the Japanese company Dashin CK in the 1950s, but then with additional versions popping up in Japan as well and making their way to the U.S. and other markets, again, with a number of different names, but generally revolving around the fact that you have a clashing mechanical noise and the likeness of a chimp. And indeed, especially with those reddened eyes, they often provoke a sense of uneasiness. They summon both the spirit of the bestial chimp and the idea of just mindless, you know, automated behavior.
Right.
There's not a lot of variation. The chimp is not a music box. It is not playing a song. It is just clashing cymbals. And it has shown up in a number of different horror properties. The best example is probably the 1980 short story by Stephen King titled The Monkey.
I remember this one.
Yeah, the basic idea here is that there's this cursed toy cymbal monkey, and every time it clashes its cymbals, somebody dies.
Yeah. I remember this. It was – does the climax involve somebody like trying to go out on a lake to throw it in the bottom or
yes.
something?
Yeah, trying to get away from it, but without raising the suspicions of the monkey.
Uh-huh.
This story, again, came out in 1980. It was published in a magazine called Gallery, which I believe was some sort of fine art magazine.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. It was a skin magazine.
Oh, I see.
But most of us probably know it from a revised version that was featured in 1985 Skeleton Crew, which was one of Stephen King's, you know, great short story collections of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Another source that some people may be remembering the story from, a 1984 film titled The Devil's Gift, which tells pretty much exactly the same story as the King short story, but without any attribution to Stephen King. And most of us know it from the MST3K Rift Merlin Shop of Mystical Wonders.
Oh, I remember that.
It features an edited down cut of this film.
That it ends up like catching people on fire and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible, but also good and also creepy. There's something about this monkey that is legitimately creepy. And I should also point out Stephen King's Skeleton Crew, first edition and many editions that came out afterwards, that collection had the cymbal-banging monkey on the cover.
Yep.
And that's all I've got on the cymbal-banging monkey.
Okay.
I mean, maybe—
Not a deep story.
Not a deep story. Maybe somewhere out there in the world we have listeners who know a deeper tale of the monkey and perhaps you'll even dare to share it with us, providing that the dark cymbal-clinging monkeys will allow you to without smiting you with their satanic power. All right. On that note, we're going to take another break. But when we come back, we will discuss paper doll theaters and some cartoon transformations.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
All right, we're back.
Okay, it seems like we're doing paper dolls now.
Yeah, I wasn't really expecting to talk about paper dolls because I don't have a lot of nostalgia for them. Like some toys, is, you know, they tend to have sort of gendered marketing, mm-hmm. and I don't think I was ever like they were never really marketed for me or purchased for me when I was a child.
Uh-huh. Oh, I should have brought up that earlier. There's actually one mention in Hewitt's paper about blocks, how there's some egregiously gendered marketing in the history of blocks. You know, like advertising blocks as for the boy constructor. You know, which is just like obviously girls like playing with blocks too.
Yeah, I mean. I think gender targeting on toys tends to be a bit dumb, but especially with blocks. If there was ever a truly gender neutral toy, mm-hmm. blocks are it. Because it's not like physics is, you know, is
it only
one
works
gender
on
or the other.
Boys.
Yeah, it's like it's part of the human experience.
No, so, don't you know when a girl makes a tower of things, it just can't fall over.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So, yeah, with paper dolls, I don't have a lot of – I remember my sisters had them, and I think I would check them out from time to time. And they were neat, you know, especially when you get into costume changes on them. Mm-hmm. But I found an interesting write-up on paper doll theaters in particular, and so that's mainly what I want to talk about here. But paper dolls in and of themselves can be pretty cool. And also if you expand that a little bit and think also of – things made out of cardboard cutouts, folded paper that is used to create some sort of likeness of a creature or a being. But of course, to have these different types of toys, you have to have paper first.
Right.
Now, paper itself has been with us for a long time, since at least the 2nd century BCE in China, mm-hmm. spreading more broadly through the Middle East and Europe in the 13th century. And we'll have to come back and do a full invention episode just on paper itself because it has a fascinating history.
Totally.
But of course, it proved extremely important for the conveyance of written language. It also was something of value, treated as such. For instance, in Western traditions, we see it in the value of books, in the reuse of parchment.
Oh, yeah. That's one thing that people often don't understand when dealing with like archaeology today. It's like, why do we have all these old documents where people would like write something on top of something else? It doesn't make any sense, but it does if you consider that writing media, the stuff you'd be writing on, was like expensive and hard to come by.
Yeah. I mean, we live in a day of very disposable paper, a day when, for instance, my son can come in and just He can just go up to the printer, grab a stack of blank sheets, and just start drawing dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
The time was when that would be completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, paper is not a plaything. Paper, in some cases, paper was sacred. I mean, paper was used in various rituals and ceremonies. We see that in Eastern examples especially. There was something sacred about it. It was a place where you put the written word, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in the East, we see origami arising, an art form that is about creating three-dimensional entities, humanoid or animal or otherwise, out of paper. And these date back to around 800 CE. We also see traditions of paper puppetry in Asia, which also resonates with the sacred, because puppetry at heart is a kind of magic to imbue created likenesses with the animation of life and then to use these animations to tell stories. And so we come back to the idea of European paper dolls, which seem to have popped up in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, becoming basically widely more available and popular as paper itself became more affordable. Because that's a key. For there to be, toys made out of paper and then for there to be widespread toys made out of paper, you've got to get the price point down.
Sure.
So I was reading an article by Amelia Soth for JSTOR Daily titled Paper Theaters, the Home Entertainment of Yesteryear.
Oh, boy.
And it discussed, another detail of paper doll history that I think I was largely unaware of. I'm pretty sure I'd seen some reprinted paper theaters at Atlanta's own Center for Puppetry Arts, but I didn't really appreciate what I was looking at and realized that this is essentially an entire puppetry art form that was very popular at one point.
Uh-huh.
So basically, during the 1800s, live theater was all the rage. It was extremely popular in Europe, especially in England.
It was the TV of the 19th century.
Yeah, if you wanted to see a story, if you wanted to watch your stories, you needed to go watch someone present them to you, right, on a stage.
But you had to leave the house.
Well, true, and we'll get to a way around that. But yeah, performance was huge. Soth writes that theatergoers at the time rebelled against Covent Garden Theater over high ticket prices by ringing bells during the show to disturb the actors and by bringing live pigs to the theater, which is fabulous. This gives me some ideas I think that we can all use in dealing with, say, the likes of Ticketmaster and so forth.
Okay.
You don't like those high prices. You don't like those scalpers coming in.
Ruin it for everybody.
Yeah. Bring a live pig and some bells to the next concert. So you also had people attending unlicensed and illegal theaters that were called blood tubs to feed their need for live performance. People could not get enough of it.
Wait, why were they called blood tubs? Do we have any idea?
I think they were just considered potentially dangerous and or violent. I mean, imagine going to an unlicensed venue for – I'm thinking like a hard rock concert, punk or metal, you know. And some of the complications that could ensue.
Yeah, those punk house shows can get kind of rough.
But then there was the home version, often for children, paper theaters. And you could, at the time, you could buy them colored or uncolored for a manner of cents. And then they would give you everything you needed for a stand-up miniature performance. You'd have a stage, a set, characters striking dramatic poses. You'd have to cut them out and then stand them up. And, of course, it would also come with a script, oftentimes edited so that the child, could handle it. If there was something, body in there, it would be removed.
Amazing. So, instead of going to the store and, buying a DVD, you'd buy a set to do a paper puppet play that comes with a script that tells you what to do.
Yeah, which is amazing, especially, again, think of a time when you didn't have DVDs, you didn't have VHS, you weren't able to just catch the movie again on television. Later, this might be the way to re-experience it, right? In a way, it's very much like a novelization of a film, except more physical.
And requiring your direct interaction to put on the performance.
Yeah, and so they were very popular, and according to Soth, they likely led to imagination play as well. Much like Legos in this regard, I'd wager. Run it through once maybe with the script, and then maybe you do a sequel to, Much Ado About Nothing. Much Ado About Nothing 2, The Revenge.
Right, first as tragedy and then as comedy.
Yeah. Now, the price, by the way, manner of sense, it's actually referenced in the title of a Robert Louis Stevenson essay about their appeal, where he's kind of, you know, waxing nostalgic about his love of these when he was a child. It's called Penny Plain, Twopence Colored, because the plain version of everything was cheaper, and if you got it already colored in, you'd have to pay a little bit more.
Oh, okay.
Stevenson, I was looking at this original piece. I looked it up. It's available online if you just do a search for that title and Robert Louis Stevenson. He writes about the joy of coloring the pages himself, that sometimes he would get the colored version for the extra cent, but it would feel wrong. He would feel like he was cheating. And he would, he'd stage a performance with the paper figures, but then he would end up studying the contents of the script booklet a lot, obsessively, and his parents would not necessarily understand like why he wasn't playing with it anymore. And he's like, it's like a big meal that I've consumed. I've already consumed it. I can't do it again, Mom and Dad. You don't understand the level of energy I'm putting into this this paper theater.
Wow.
Soth also points out that Goethe's son, August, would put on shows in a paper theater and that, quote, the family cat always served as one of the performers.
Oh, like getting in there and swatting at the puppets, sure. They would love that.
So Soth concludes, quote, the magic of the paper theater was not that it allowed children to replicate a beloved play in their home. It was that it provided them with the raw materials either to copy or create, to follow or subvert as they saw fit. So it gave children a full cast and setting of physical representations for imagination play. And in some cases, I imagine, such an array possible, given that some children, many children even, would not have had access to, say, a Toy Story 4-esque cast of material characters. You wouldn't have like a toy chest of animals and people, representations thereof, with which to do this kind of imagination play. But one of these sets, for a mere penny, you would have good guys and bad guys in a setting, everything you need.
And the script. Seems like a huge part of it. I mean, I think about how actually this is seeming so weird to me, but at the same time, I'm like, well, that's sort of what I did with my action figures. Like, when I played with like Jurassic Park action figures or whatever, I could like have them sort of put on a play.
Yeah. Another thing that I read was that people like Ingmar Bergman and Orson Welles would use toy theaters to stage things out in miniature for actual performances or productions.
Mm-hmm.
So, this in and of itself, too, it's just a useful exercise to be able to create in miniature what you may one day create in real life as an actual, say, theatrical production or a cinematic production. Yeah, these were super popular for quite a while. Now, among other things, television helped to decrease the appeal of these paper theaters and toy theaters in general. But they live on to this day, sometimes in a nostalgic form, an old toy kind of form. But then you also see them utilized as a true craft by some individuals, or even as a performance art, even as a way of performing through a type of puppetry.
Well, I feel like I want to get one of these things.
Yeah. I have seen them for sale I've seen updated versions of them for sale at, say, the Center for Puppetry Arts. So next time I go, I'm going to have to check it out.
Maybe they make a Jurassic Park paper puppet set.
It would be great, actually, because just think of it. Instead of buying all these big pieces of plastic or building them out of Legos or what have you, and then building things for the dinosaurs to knock down out of bricks and blocks, what have you. In paper form, you could have everything. You could have all the major dinosaurs, all the major players. You could even have who's the lawyer in the first Jurassic Park?
Gennaro, or what, the actor's name?
Well, I don't know about either one. You could have that guy, and you could even rip him in half. He even comes into two pieces.
Oh, that's
right.
Yeah, very easy to dismember paper puppets.
There you go.
You know what I'd do?
What's that?
Flip script. Then you have dinosaurs make a park with humans in it. The humans get loose.
There you go. See, this is exactly it. Like, it allows you to make all the changes, all the alterations that you might be inspired to create.
Now, Robert, you promised me that we would end up talking about some kind of cartoon transformation. What's the deal here?
All right. Yeah. I have one final thing that you had to talk about here, and it's something that I never thought that I would really come up on the show. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to list several different Japanese cartoon characters that were indeed each of them made into some sort of toy, and I want you to figure out what they have in common.
Okay.
You have Mum-Ra the Ever-Living from Thundercats. You remember Mum-Ra?
I actually never watched Thundercats.
Okay, so Mum-Ra is like an old, decrepit mummy, like kind of a cat person mummy.
Okay.
And then at a certain point in the show, he's going to have to battle. So he has to transform into Mum-Ra the Ever-Living, which is this big, like super muscular cat creature with like sort of Thulsa Doom-esque Egyptian-inspired garb.
It's like in the Stephen Sommers mummy movies when the skeleton critter turns into Arnold Vosloo.
Yeah, very similar. I imagine they might have even been inspired by old Mum-Ra. Another example, Monstar, Silverhawks. This was a villain it was a sci-fi sort of counterpart to Thundercats. Then, of course, we had Voltron. You remember Voltron?
Oh, I definitely remember Voltron.
Mm-hmm. And then you had Sailor Moon.
Aware of it, but I never watched it.
Okay. So what do they all have in common?
Well, I know the answer because I can see your notes, but I don't know if I would have gotten it otherwise. Clearly, now that I know the answer, it's that they all have like a scene where they go like, power up, and then they transform into their higher form.
That's right. Yeah. Lengthy transformation scenes. I was not familiar with all of these properties. I don't think I've ever watched Sailor Moon, and probably, you know, that gets into gendered marketing, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But I was a big Thundercats and Voltron fan growing up. I would catch Silverhawks when it was on. I always found it like a little weird. It didn't have the true magic of Thundercats.
Uh-huh.
But these were fun shows, and yes, the transformation scenes were awesome. And they sometimes would use like a full transformation. Sometimes they would use a shorter version of it, seemingly depending on how much how much they had to pad out the episode.
Right.
because that really seemed to have been key here, right? Because it's a great way to pad out an animated series, especially when you consider a show like Thundercats, which went 4 seasons, 130 episodes. Silverhawks only went 1 season, and it still had 65 episodes. So they're really churning these puppies out.
Yeah, but you film a transformation scene, you can basically just use the same one every time.
Right. You can bank, generally, most of these we're looking at, you're talking 20 seconds, mm-hmm. which maybe doesn't seem about a lot, but when you get into the cost of animation, et cetera, it makes a difference. It's called the bank method, apparently. By the way, Sailor Moon, 5 seasons, 200 episodes.
Wow.
So yes, on one hand, you can look at it and say, well, this is a good way to fill up an episode. Just have 20 seconds or so that you can depend on, not counting the intro and the outro to the episode, which are already going to be pretty stationary. I was looking at JSTOR Daily again, and I ran across a post titled Selling Toys with the Sailor Moon Transformation Sequence. And this was very insightful and made me think about this in a new way. This was by Jacqueline Mansky in October of 2019. And it was largely a look at the work of Kumiko Saito in the Journal of Asian Studies.
Okay.
So this all points out that the transformation scenes, like the ones we've discussed, but more specifically like the one in Sailor Moon, are more than we might imagine they are. So in Sailor Moon, we have a normal Japanese schoolgirl, and she transforms into the pretty guardian Sailor Moon.
The pretty guardian.
Yes. apparently this was like a standard part of magical girl animation prior to Sailor Moon. And one presumes that, it connects to the transformations in the Thundercats and Voltron shows.
Uh-huh.
Again, just sort of like a differently gendered version of the same thing.
Uh-huh.
It dates back at least to the 1982 animated series Minky Momo, which was a magical princess show that featured a standard 23-second transformation scene. By the time Sailor Moon comes around, though, they get that transformation scene up to 40 seconds.
Wow. Well, this is interesting that you've got this, animation production padding technique that is being used over and over in all these different series to make the cartoon production more affordable. But how does this connect to toys?
All right. This is what Saito has to write about it. She says, quote, although the technique of reusing cells in multiple episodes was not a new concept in itself, Momo, by which she means Minky Momo from 82, successfully incorporated the well-exploited robot anime's bank method in which mechanical parts are captured in the camera's dynamic tracking motion for the maximum effect of promoting the target merchandise. So in other words, if I'm understanding this correctly, it's you ever see these scenes where it's like the showroom for an automobile?
Yeah.
It's on this circular stage that's revolving and all the fancy lights are on it to just give you this 360, fabulous, nonstop view of just how wonderful this vehicle is from every angle.
It's like the character creation screen in a wrestling video game.
Exactly.
You know, where they let you rotate to every angle, you know, inspect the feet, all that stuff.
Right. So, yeah, if I'm understanding this correctly, the argument is that is what this is. Like, yes, it's a banking method. Yes, it's part of each story. It's part of the imaginative element of the tale.
But so, like, you're trying to sell Voltron action figures or Sailor Moon action figures, and this allows you to do that within every episode of the show, to have like a merchandise show-off segment that gives you lots of different angles and stuff to examine the toy that you want to buy.
Yeah, so Mum-Ra does his 20-second transformation scene. I think I tried to clock it. I think it's like 23 seconds. And you look at it and you're like, man, Mum-Ra's amazing. This is the central villain of the show is the best. And I simply must own the toy. And I did own the toy of Mum-Ra. Like, I remember, I didn't connect the two, but it's like I had to have Mum-Ra. I had Mum-Ra. I had none of the other Thundercats. But I had to have Mum-Ra. And I probably would have gotten Monstar as well, but I couldn't really move my 8-year-old funds around enough to make it happen. but this is a...
Couldn't get an injection of capital for that.
Right. Yeah. But I think this is a really fascinating take on it. I mean, obviously we know that if there is a cartoon that has a toy line,
yeah,
and sometimes the cartoon comes first, sometimes the toy line comes first, sometimes they're part of the same effort. You know, we know on some level that cartoon is about selling the toys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's totally the case with like Transformers, right? The cartoon was there to sell the toys.
But I had not really considered something about the transformation scene, about how this might be a key tool in the toy makers, the toy marketers' toolbox.
Well, that's funny because now that I'm thinking of Transformers, of course, duh. I mean, also extended transformation scenes.
Yeah, you see this once you sort of clued into this idea, you see it in so many shows. Yeah, Transformers, even some shows that are perhaps, you know, not cartoons. I guess in Power Rangers, stuff had to come together. Some sort of transformation had to happen. It becomes – and part of this too is that it becomes a trope of such shows, right? It becomes a thing that people expect and they get excited about. And maybe to a certain extent, the creators don't even realize the ways that it can be used, that it has this marketing effect as well.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I've never considered this before.
Now, again, I only have personal experience with Mum-Ra and Monstar and Voltron, but I would love to hear from anyone out there who can really speak to Sailor Moon and some of these other Princess Transformation shows and provide a little insight on this.
You know, now that I'm thinking about it, I actually have come across other examples of this where like specifically cinema techniques being used to emphasize toy selling aspects. The main example I'm thinking of are in Batman movies, like in the second Joel Schumacher Batman movie, Batman and Robin, from I guess it was the late 90s.
Oh yeah,
I remember there's all this talk after the film came out about how like the film had been shaped by the need to market toys that would be sold in conjunction with the film. To emphasize the bat vehicles and stuff in certain ways that would make it, they thought, more appealing for a toy market.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if I ever saw that one all the way through, but even the earlier Batman movies, I mean, clearly you got to move some Batmobiles, and so you feature the Batmobile prominently. But then again, would it be a Batman film if it didn't have a Batmobile in it? It becomes kind of hard to pull these elements apart again, right?
I've been trying to think of like an Arnold Schwarzenegger Price ice pun. It didn't come together right.
It was such hilarious and awful casting as Mr. Freeze.
It's one of the all-time greats.
Yeah. Because I remember even at the time, I was always a Mr. Freeze fan.
Uh-huh.
Even like the really crappy Mr. Freeze version that you had in the old Adam West series, I would still get excited for him when he was on the screen.
Oh, I didn't know that. I remember he was always so scary and tragic in the animated series.
Yeah, he's wonderful in the animated series. I fell in love with him again, fell in love with him anew when that came out. And then here comes Arnold, and you're like, who did this? Like, who so completely missed the mark on what this character is and what they should be cinematically?
But they sold a lot of toys, though.
That's true. And it is at least comedically noteworthy. All right. So there you have it. I think this is good. I think we're going to close the toy bag for the year.
It's been a heck of a haul.
It has. Obviously, there were tons of toys we did not get to. But we can always come back in the future, especially if these are popular. And then, of course, you know, we're going to cover more inventions in the new year. We'd love to hear from everyone out there. What do you want to hear about? What technologies? What specific inventions? Big inventions? Small inventions? Really, I would love to hear from everyone regarding, like, what you like about the show. If you like invention, if you want invention to keep going, what sort of topics and content are you finding the most engaging? Do you like multi-episodes that deal with something bigger like photography? Do you like self-contained episodes that are looking at a singular invention? Do you like grab bag episodes like these toy episodes? I would just love to know what you think as a listener. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can go to inventionpod.com, and that'll take you to a page for us. And, yeah, wherever you get the show, just make sure you rate and review. That is a great way to support the show. Also, subscribe. That way, you'll always get new episodes when they arrive.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you'd like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story. One passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.